Hello, hello! Welcome to How to Be a Changemaker. I am so excited to have you here. If you are an organizational leader and have a deep desire to, one, motivate yourself better and to lead yourself with deeper courage, confidence, and conviction, two, empower your employees to be their best, and three, innovate and create a work culture that allows everybody to thrive, you are in the right place. My name is Samantha Clark. I am your host. I'm a happiness consultant and resident change maker here, and I cannot wait to share with you all the gems and amazing goodness in this episode. Take a seat, get ready to enjoy, and tuck in. Hello, hello. Today I am joined by Tria Bryant, who is just a phenomenal woman working in the space of diversity, inclusion, and really trying to encompass a more inclusive organizational space. Hello, Tria.
Good morning. Well, I think good afternoon for you, Samantha, right?
Yes, good morning for you. How is it on your side of the world?
It is 8 a.m. in beautiful Houston, and I think we're going to have a wonderful day to hear, Tegan.
Oh, I love that. It is somewhat sunny, cloudy, cold here, heading into that autumn bleakness, unfortunately. But one way I love to start our podcast is I'd love to find out three words that you think really exemplify who you are and how you show up and add value into the world.
Wow. I love that question, Samantha. I don't frequently get that. So I think the first three words that just naturally come to mind are bold, unapologetic, and curious.
I like that. Yeah. What are you most unapologetic about?
Being a Black woman, period. Mm. And I haven't always been that way in my career, so I'm really proud that I can very confidently say that and speak on that, but more so show up and act on that in my day-to-day. It took a while to get there. I don't think that as Black women in this world, but particularly at work, I provided the space to come and be our authentic selves.
What do you think was the tipping point for you to step into and honor all of your unapologetic badassery as a Black woman?
I think some of it was industry and career. Starting my career in the military, it's more rigid and regimented. And, you know, I had a lot of fantastic mentors and sponsors that wanted me to be successful, but I believe that you had to be a certain prototype. As a Black woman, as an officer in the United States Air Force, to be successful. And I wanted to be successful. And I think it was, you know, then after 7 years active duty, I then pivoted into Wall Street financial services, and I worked at Goldman Sachs, and it was similar there, but I started to find myself more and more. But it wasn't until I came into tech that I really was inspired by those around me that I saw being their authentic selves and saying, I can do that too. And it feels really good. And it's something even as simple as it wasn't, believe it or not, Samantha, it wasn't until over 10 years into my professional career, 10 years that I wore my natural hair out at work.
Ooh, okay. 10 years. Wow. So I'd love to take a step back and think, okay, so you've traversed military, you've been in finance, and now you're in tech. What made it possible for you to pivot? And you mentioned mentors and those kind of supporters who were really trying to galvanize you moving forwards. Like, what made those pivots happen? And how do you think that, I think you really started to hone your voice along the way?
Yeah, it's, again, it goes back to that being intellectually curious, but I like to go to where the fire is. I like to run towards the fire. And I have a very strong work ethic. You know, I will always say I'm not going to be the smartest person in the room, I'm not going to be the most knowledgeable person in the room, but you cannot outwork me. And it's not about working harder. It's about working efficiently and effectively. Mm-hmm. And what has really allowed me to pivot across different industries and roles is that I very quickly become that person that's like, oh, you can't get that done? Go give it to Trier. She'll get it done, right? She'll know someone who can get it done. She may not know how to do it, but she will figure it out and she will get it done. And that becomes a superpower in organizations with strong leaders that want to get things done. And I appreciate the Air Force Academy instilling that into me of, you know, when we graduated, they were like, you're going to be a second lieutenant and your job is to be a leader. You're not going to be the subject matter experts. That's what your enlisted troops are, but you have to lead them to set them up for success. And so I have approached my entire career in a very comfortable way of, I don't actually have to know how to do the work. I just have to know how to lead the folks that know how to do the work to get it done and to get it done as effectively and successfully as possible.
And that's a really key point to hone in on. It's, and I think a lot of the work that you do is really understanding how do we build and facilitate relationships to get work done? How do we actually organize different personalities, different needs and wants to kind of move in a direction?
Right.
And what would you say are some of the qualities that have really stand you in good stead now when you think about tech? So you've talked about your work ethic. How do you, I guess, handle difficult conversations with people? I think a lot of your work is provocative. We're going to come on to the book and the company that you work in. How do you get people to have difficult conversations, or what do you think you've mastered along the way to support getting the work done?
Yeah, I think, you know, we all have ego, but I do my best to not allow my ego to surface and to dominate in all my relationships, both personal and professional. So one of the things that I don't know, like people feel really uncomfortable just saying, I don't know, or I made a mistake, right? And I'm very comfortable failing forward. It's one of my favorite books, John C. Maxwell. But getting comfortable with the uncomfortable. And I think managing expectations and being over communicative. So that has really helped me both when I was getting the work done, but now when I need to have challenging and difficult conversations with senior leaders on some topics that make people feel very uncomfortable, especially those from the majority groups. But I come from a place of empathy. I also come from a place of every day I'm still learning and we're still figuring this out. And by no means does anyone have all the answers or the quote unquote right way to do it, but there's definitely a better way to do it. And that's okay. You know, diversity, equity, inclusion is not like building a stack. It's not like building a platform or an app. It is, we're dealing with people. We're dealing with humans that are unpredictable and are so complex, right? And different and unique in the different cultures. And it's really exciting, but it's also challenging, but it's doable. And I think that, you know, different ways that you can open the hearts and minds of folks to step out of themselves and to, you know, just think about how other people are experiencing their workplace, their jobs, meetings. And ultimately what I tell leaders is, I don't care if you think this is the right thing to do. I don't care if you think that we need to have more women in leadership roles. That's not what's important to me. I don't care if it's the right thing to do, because most leaders are not focused on that. Most leaders are focused on their bottom line, and I have to meet them where they're at. And so I meet them where they're at, saying, by actually investing in this and caring, you will increase your bottom line. You will optimize for your effectiveness. You will, you know, have more impactful, successful, more innovative teams. And that's what gets their attention.
So let's dig a little bit deeper here when we think about diversity, inclusion, equity in the workplace. You've traversed landscapes in like talent development and, you know, really looking at what it takes to kind of build workforces that are diverse. Where do you think the conversation or what evolutions have you seen in the conversation since you started working till now?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking that question because it has evolved. And, you know, so when I was, there's really no HR, human resources in the military. When you're a leader and you're a commander, you're doing all of that on your own with your teams. Mm-hmm. And there is this concept, there's, you know, one of the things that they say in the military is you take care of your people and your people take care of the mission. Mm-hmm. And so that was deeply ingrained in me. And that's how I led. And that's how I approached my teams and my peers. Like, you, like, we take care of our people and people will take care of everything else. And then when I pivoted out of the military into the civilian sector with Wall Street, you know, being the first industry, it became very, very clear that outside of the military, there was a very myopic view of what taking care of your people meant. It was like compensation, money, benefits. And then you transition to tech and it was like free lunch, bring your dog to the office, right? Massages. And it's like, yeah, that's fine. But like, people are struggling like with other things outside of the outside of the office. And like, how are we supporting with that? How are we giving them those resources? Mm-hmm. And so I think what's interesting is with COVID happening, COVID has forced organizations to pay attention to what is going on for their employees outside of work, because we are very quickly seeing how it has just, you know, it brings into the work where so many folks are still working remotely from home and your office and your child's school is right next door to each other because you've got to do homeschooling for your kids because they are at home as well. And mm-hmm. down the hall is your, you know, your partner, significant other's office and they're working. So it's really just melded everything together, and we've had to think differently about what it means to take care of our people. And I think this is long, long overdue. We're seeing organizations have more conversations about wellness, about mental health, about parents and caregivers, what support can they give? And I think that we're seeing organizations have a more holistic view of their employees and their talent, which again is, I think, overlooked. And for the organizations who are not doing that, you will be left behind and you will not be an employer of choice. And this is definitely an employee's market, right? Like, there is a war for talent, and really strong talent, the world is their oyster, and they can choose whatever they want.
Where do you believe the work needs to begin to really do deep dive systemic work around diversity, inclusion, and equity? Because, you know, some of us might question that, you know, the events of George Floyd are like really disrupted things at work, but some things are returning to normal, or there seems to be issues that are surpassing that, or people are, you know, papering over the cracks with different solutions. Like, where do we need to get started with this?
We need organizations to engage with diversity, equity, and inclusion the same way as they do with their business functions. That means the way that you have a chief technology officer that is responsible for your engineering and your technology, you need to have a leader for your DE&I. The way that you have a chief marketing officer that's responsible for your messaging and your marketing, you need to have a leader focused on DE&I. We need to get away from this perspective and point of view that it's like, oh, DE&I is additive, or for the folks who really care about it, we'll give them small swim lanes to do things. And oftentimes the people who care about it the most are the ones who are impacted by poor practices the most, which are underrepresented folks. Those are the women, those are the non-white professionals within the organization. And so not only are they, I have a theory that most underrepresented professionals are surviving, not thriving in their roles and in their companies. So if you take the audience and the population that's surviving, that's doing their best to keep their head above water, investing time outside of their job that their company pays them for to help and support the diversity efforts through the most common thing that we see is the diversity working group. Mm-hmm. But with no resources, no leadership, of course you're not going to see anything happen, right? Like it's, you know, I tell leaders and founders all the time, you had this idea, and when you were ready to go build the product, what did you do? You hired engineers. And when you were ready to PM the product, you hired product folks. And when you were ready to sell the product, you hired salespeople. You go out and you hire folks that are subject matter experts that bring that depth, that know how to do it, and you pay them. Why do we not do that when it comes to diversity, equity, inclusion? Okay, that's one group of organizations. The next group of organizations is they go and they hire a chief diversity officer. They go hire someone to lead their diversity effort. But then you look at the person's background and it's like, do you really know DE&I? Or were you just a really senior woman in the organization? Someone was like, oh, you're a woman. Like, you should now run our diversity efforts. And so now we've got these senior quote unquote DE&I leaders that cannot put pen to paper for strategy, do not know the best or common practices in this space. And we're doing this recycling of just sitting on panels and having conversations and going to conferences and defining the problem in every way possible, but we're actually not doing the work.
Mm. And I find sometimes there's a lot of DEI initiatives that seem to speak to the people who are already converted, you know, who understand that this work is needed, but they don't either have the power at a C-suite level to really make the changes necessary.
That's right.
How do you, like, what are the biggest blocks at a C-suite level for them to take this seriously? Like,
yeah. One, you have to actually know. If you don't think this is a problem in your organization, then you either, one, don't know what you're looking for, mm-hmm. or two, you don't know where to find it. Because I assure you, these workplace injustice and inequities are all over in our organization because it is systemic. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I was, we do these sessions called, well, we don't call the sessions anything, but it's basically we work with executive teams and mm-hmm. we create a space for clumsy curiosity.
Okay.
And that's really important because a lot of leaders, they feel like they have to show up and have all the answers and say the right things. But when you actually put them in a, we don't call them safe spaces. We call them brave space where you can be brave to have the courage to ask those questions that, you know, have that clumsy curiosity. We find that there's so much that leaders don't know. And so that is actually, I think, the number one barrier. They just don't know what they don't know. And it's so foreign and they're so uncomfortable. And I think that in this cancel culture and this social media where, like, you know, people are just afraid of, like, I'm not going to say anything because I'm not going to say the right thing. So let's just avoid it altogether. Mm-hmm. No, we need to have the conversations and let's talk about it. And language, actually, Samantha, has, you know, really unlocked some very fruitful conversations for leaders. Because in the United States, you know, we get questions like, Trier, should I say African-American? Should I say Black? Hispanic? Mm-hmm. Latinx? Latine? Latino? What's the difference? LGBTQIA+? I don't know what all the letters mean, right? And if you don't if you're not comfortable with just language, then that's going to be your number one barrier to, like, barrier to enter the conversation. So we do spend a lot of time on language and we spend a lot of time of just creating a space for clumsy curiosity to ask your questions, to get past the unknowns, and then to start asking the questions that you need to be asking so that you can hire a leader to do the work that needs to be done.
Mm. So you've partnered with Kim Scott and you run an organization called Just Work, which is basically, you know, based on the incredible book. Tell me a little bit more about your framework for really fighting, as you call it, bias, prejudice, and bullying in the workplace. Like, how do we begin to, I guess, peel back the layers around these three areas and start to make change?
Yeah. So Kim Scott is a New York Times bestseller. Her first book, Radical Candor, is fantastic. And I remember when someone gave that to me to read, as I was reading it, I was like, yes, this is what people need. This is how we give feedback in the military. Yes, yes, yes. Like, everyone else do this. Kim's superpower is she has this very special way of taking, like, nuanced human experiences and putting them on a 2x2 because Kim thinks that you can solve all problems with a 2x2. but really making them practical and tactical for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so when she reached out and, you know, she was like, I'm looking for a co-founder for, you know, my company, Just Work, that's going to, you know, I want to build this and in tandem with the book coming out. I was like, Kim, I don't have time for this. I was a chief people officer at a startup. We were trying to launch rockets in the middle of COVID. I had 80% of my employees that came into work all the way through COVID because, you know, the Department of Defense and the Air Force and the Space Force were our clients. And they were like, yeah, shelter in place doesn't matter. You all are in support of national security. Go back to work. So it was a really, really challenging time for me as a chief people officer. And, you know, and I was like, but I'll read the book and I'll just give you some feedback. Well, Samantha, I read that book and I was blown away. I was like, this is exactly what we need. And I called her and I said, Kim, we're going to start this company and we need to do it yesterday. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about whatever vertical industry you're from, or even just taking leadership as an example, there are probably hundreds of leadership frameworks, right? Leadership philosophies, frameworks, all these different resources. And you learn about different things and you pull things that you like or that works for you and you put them in your toolkit. Mm-hmm. When it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion, we don't have that. We don't have frameworks. We don't have tools that are practical and tactical that everyone can just use and leverage that can immediately start changing behaviors. Because the thing that we know about workplace injustice, which we define the root causes of workplace injustice in the Just Work framework as bias, prejudice, bullying. And the simple mm-hmm. definitions that we use is bias is not meaning it, unconscious. Prejudice is meaning it, it's a conscious belief. And then bullying is just being mean, right? Because you're looking to cause harm. Mm-hmm. But the thing that we know about bias is that bias is a pattern. And we can break that pattern. And so that's one of the things we talk about in the framework is bias disruptors. How do we disrupt that bias, interrupt that bias in the moment so we don't allow it to continue and to perpetuate? And so what's really powerful about the book and the framework is that after an hour, you know, keynote with us or a session, employees are immediately leaving that and going into their next meetings. And we've heard this feedback time and time again, which Kim and I just absolutely love, is that, you know, people will say, and then I went to my next meeting and I disrupted bias. And like immediately, right? And it's about how do you have that shared vocabulary, those shared norms that we're all like, hey, this is how we define bias. This is how we define prejudice. This is how we define bullying. And when we find ourselves in these situations, right, whether we're the person who's being harmed, the person who causes harm, an upstander who's a bystander who intervenes, or a leader, these are the things that you can do. And these are the things that you should expect people to do.
So you're really giving people, you know, you're breaking it down and saying, actually, it's not just a top-down initiative. We all have the power to be disruptors here.
That's right.
Yeah, I love the way that you've broken it down into, you know, if somebody is on the receiving end, like what is going to be your response? So what are some of the responses that we can lean into if we feel that we are constantly susceptible or on the receiving end of prejudice and bias? And how do we do that in a company that maybe can't see it from the person's perspective?
Right. So one of the things we talk about is we call them our statements. So again, if the root causes of workplace injustice that we see over and over again in the workplace is bias, prejudice, and bullying, when you are confronted with bias, and this could be, you know, you could be in any of these roles, we encourage folks to use an I statement. Mm-hmm. So if you're exhibiting, if you are observing bias, you know, and an example of this could be, and this has happened very frequently, right? How often have you like been in a meeting and you might be the only woman and you're actually the lead for the project or, you know, that meeting, but the people who are attending that meeting are men and they will direct their questions to, you know, the man on your team. This used to happen to me all the time in the military. Like, I would come into the room with my team and there would be three people on my team and the generals would always direct their questions to, you know, the other men, even though like I outranked them. So in that situation, an I statement would be like, you know, I would say, I don't think that we're actually going to be successful on this mission if, you know, you continue to ask questions to my team versus, you know, me and I'm the person that has the information. It's inviting them in, right? It's inviting them in to understand from your perspective. So it could be like, hey, if someone, you know, Kim tells a story about how when she was, someone called her honey at work. And so in that situation, a good I statement is, I don't think that you're going to take me seriously, you know, if I'm going to work in an environment where people call women honey. And so it's, again, it's disrupting that bias. It's calling them in and making them see and understand from your perspective, you know, what's going on. Versus with prejudice, we encourage folks to use an it statement. And an it statement actually focuses on the prejudice. So for example, I worked at a company once where a hiring manager didn't end up hiring a Black woman because she interviewed with her natural hair and she didn't think that it was professional to put the Black woman in front of the business and in this role with her natural hair. So an it statement in that moment would be, it is against our hiring practices to not hire someone for a reason outside of the job description. It is ridiculous that we are even considering not hiring someone because of their hair. Or you can appeal to the law. And in the United States, in 11 states, although it should be all 50, it is illegal to not hire someone because of their hair. So when someone has prejudice and they have that conscious belief, we want to use an it statement to focus on the prejudice. And then bullying, you want to use a you statement. So if an I statement invites someone in, a you statement pushes them away. So if someone's being, you know, disrespectful in a meeting, saying, you can't talk to me that way. You are being unprofessional, right? So it's pushing them away and putting the light on them. And then sometimes, you know, and I think that right now, especially in COVID, like we all just need to show everyone grace and people are doing the best they can with what they have. I've often used you statements like, hey, what's going on with you right now? Are you okay? So those are some of the statements that we encourage folks to use: the I statement, the it statement, and the you statement.
And how do you think these fare cross-culturally? I mean, I can imagine definitely from across the US, some of these statements might be more approachable, but are you working with international companies and do you see any resistance to cultures that might be a little bit more saving face or, you know, public facing and maybe a you statement feels a little bit triggering?
Yeah. Well, I would love to hear your perspective on that, Samantha, but what I can tell you is we do have international clients. We haven't heard anything specifically like that, but I will tell you there's even organizations in the US that are like, ooh, that feels really uncomfortable. Like, you know, like, I don't know if I feel comfortable doing that, but that's why if you use this framework across the whole company and you educate everyone on it, then again, you're managing people's expectations. So if you say, hey, we're going to implement and we're going to use a Just Work framework. So if you bully someone, they are going to meet you with a you statement. So then when someone does, you're like, oh, wow. I'm bullying. Okay. Yes. And so I think it's about, again, when you have the shared language and the shared norms, it's like, hey, in this workplace, we're going to, you know, use a you statement when we feel like we are observing bullying or prejudice or bias, right? Or an it statement or an I statement. So I think that for the organizations have found the most success is when they are bringing the entire organization along on this journey and doing the work to really educate and inform everyone. So it's not as abrupt or abrasive as it may be, but like in this conversation, right? If I used a you statement with you, it might feel a little harsh, but now that you understand it, right, it would land a little differently.
yeah, because I could see where you're building it out through the equation, and you're informing me is kind of empowering, right? And it's also getting me to readdress my behavior or to sit and reflect on it at least.
That's right. That's right. And the other, and so when we also talk about the four roles again, and that's another thing, is that the framework is incredibly inclusive in the sense of, like, we're acknowledging that even in one meeting, you can play all four roles. Like, I have been in an hour long meeting where I have been the person who's been harmed. I've been the person who caused harm. I've been an upstander, and I've been the leader who didn't prevent it, right? Because the person who is being harmed, they have a responsibility. They have a role and a responsibility to respond, but you can also choose not to respond. We don't want to take someone's agency away from them, because we've all been in those moments where you just don't have the energy in that moment to respond, right? Mm-hmm. And then if you're the person who's causing harm, you have a role and responsibility to listen and to learn. And if you are, you know, we want folks to be an upstander, which means we want you to have the role and responsibility to intervene. And then leaders have a role and responsibility to prevent these workplace injustices from occurring. So within the framework, we think about the root causes of workplace injustice, and then what does everyone do based on these different roles and responsibilities? And then the last thing that I'll say, because this is very important, is then the second part of the framework is what happens when power is introduced into the equation, because we have to take that into account as well. And so what happens is that when power is introduced, power plus bias or prejudice creates the conditions for discrimination. Power plus bullying creates the conditions for harassment. And then power plus touch is when we have physical violations. Mm-hmm. And we have to be aware of that, because we know that there are both there's power structures, both from like in hierarchy and structural from like, you know, roles and titles, but then also it could be physical power. But then also just power from, you know, from privilege in the workplace as well. And how is that introduced? And then how does that change the situation and the dynamics?
And so what is the conversation that you start to have with a leader who maybe abusing power or isn't aware of power abuse amongst their team?
Yeah, this is a conversation that Kim and I, we have often. We recently did a Clubhouse session that was supposed to be an hour and then ended up being 2 hours because it just got so deep and so good. But, you know, one of the things that I also love about working with Kim is, you know, if everyone is thinking the same, then like someone's not thinking. So Kim and I, we think very differently on a lot of the topics that we discuss. And I think it just makes us that much stronger. Mm-hmm. And when we're working with our clients, but also understanding that Kim Scott is a white woman and I am a Black woman. Mm-hmm. And there's also an age difference between us as well. And I think what's been very interesting is that both Kim and I have learned how our intersections impact the biases, prejudice, and even bullying that we experience. I think that she has really seen, oh my gosh, she sees firsthand these injustices that I experience. And she's like, I just wasn't noticing it. And then I notice much more like her privilege in other areas that, you know, I just don't benefit from. So when it comes to the topic of power, Kim hates power. Kim is like, power is bad. Power corrupts. And I'm just like, you say that because you come from a position of power. You've had power. Whereas I don't feel that way about power. I think that power needs to be used for good and not abused. But power is influence, and power is how we change things. And I know that when I have gotten into positions of power or had power, I'm using it for good to change and make things more equitable and inclusive. Mm-hmm. And so we have these conversations. So, you know, one of the things we talk about in the framework is not having any unilateral power to make any decisions, whether that's hiring or firing or really anything in the organization. When it comes to your people, when it comes to your people processes. But we do have differing opinions on, you know, how to yield that power. Because, you know, Kim just wants everything to be like a flat organization and power is bad. And I'm just like, no, how do we get power into the hands of those who have not had it, who have been marginalized, who have been oppressed and systemically held down? And what happens when you provide them with the power to do better and to create change? Really amazing things can happen. So those are conversations to be had about who has power in your organization, who has influence, who's making decisions, who's in the room. And, you know, we talk a lot about, oh, having a seat at the table. It is not just about having a seat at the table, because we're seeing too many organizations that are inviting people to have a seat at the table, but they're not, one, they're not feeding everyone the same, which means we need to pay people equitably, but they're also not giving everyone the same voice. And so we have to be very explicit when we're talking about having a seat at the table, because I want more folks, underrepresented folks, to have a seat at the table. But that also means that everyone needs to get fed the same equally. And we need to have, you know, their voices need to be heard.
Love this. When you think about yourself as a change maker, what are your hopes for change within the organization, but also how we treat each other at work over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years?
I'll be honest, Samantha, that's a hard one to be optimistic about following all of the events of last year. Mm-hmm. And to your point earlier, I mean, my phone, my email, my DMs blew up following the murder of George Floyd. Organizations did not know what to do. And what was even more, which is more detrimental to organizations, is a lot of organizations, when COVID first happened, right, people were just like, hey, we just need to like save money. People were cutting teams, cutting employees, doing layoffs. And a lot of organizations cut their diversity teams, their diversity budgets. Those are usually the first to go because people don't find value in them and don't understand it. And then everything happened around George Floyd, Breonna Taylor. I mean, like, there was just this uprising, right? This overdue racial awakening that the United States had. Mm-hmm. And organizations didn't know what to do. And so a lot of them did the right thing of working with consultants and experts, subject matter experts outside, to bring them in. But what's hard is now, again, to your point earlier, is that like now it seems like we're just going back to the status quo. Like, it was a moment. And the other thing that was a lesson learned for my team and myself was we did all this work with organizations on like playbooks, strategies, initiatives. Like, this is how you can deal with the moment. This is how you wrap your arms around your employees that are struggling and dealing with this, right? How do you check in on them? What are your internal communications? What are your external communications? How are you investing in the community? How are you showing up with monies and resources, but also time? And then Stop Asian Hate happened. And we were seeing this increase of violence and hate against the Asian community. And so many of our clients were like, Trier, what do we do? Just work. What do we do? And we were like, what do you mean? What do you do? We just went through this. And so many of them were like, oh, no, no, no. That's what we do for the Black community. What do we do for eight? And it's like, no, it wasn't the Black playbook. It wasn't the Black strategy. It was the marginalized community, oppressed community, the communities that like who are struggling right now because of these injustices. And so when we've said, you know what to do, go do it, so many of them were like, oh, okay, we didn't know that. And I didn't think that we had to be that specific or that hand holding with it. But that was, we had several of our clients that had missteps with Stop Asian Hate and really showing up for the Asian community during that time. And yes, there were some cultural nuances, but for the most part, right, when you have a community that's hurting and fighting, it's empathy. It's simply just showing up and caring.
And going beyond, like, you know, this particular group, this is what we do here. And for the neurodiverse group, we do this. It's actually just flatlining everything and just saying, what am I not seeing here?
That's right. Because oftentimes, inclusion has to be inclusive. And unfortunately, oftentimes it's not.
So when you think about this amazing work that you're doing in companies and the way that you're also leading your life, how do you look after yourself as a change maker? Like, what are you doing to make sure that you remain well, sane, productive, happy, even when you feel like maybe you might be speaking to a brick wall in some cases, or that things are changing slower than you'd like? What is in your happiness toolkit?
Yes. Okay. So three things that I love sharing because I just feel so strongly about them. One, I got to a certain point in my life where I said, I have to either be working with a therapist or an executive coach at all times, either or, because you have to have someone that's an outlet, right? And so depending on, like, hey, do I need someone to really help me with things in my personal life, or do I need someone to help me professionally, will determine, like, hey, am I going to be, you know, seeing my therapist, or am I going to be seeing my executive coach? Right now I see both. Okay. Because Samantha, we need all the support. We need all the support right now. So right now, and for like, probably like since COVID, I'm like, whoo, I need my coach. And I definitely need my therapist. So that's one. But I think that in making that investment is, and like, look, we know there's so much stigma around therapy and seeing someone, and especially within like the Black community, but it's like, we have to get past that, because I just think that by the time you hit the age of 34, you should have at least been to therapy at least once. Not because anything is wrong, but because we are a product of our upbringing and our past, and like handle your baggage. I also have this theory that when someone said, what is the one thing that you could do to make managers better? I said, give them therapy.
Oh, hell yeah.
Right? Right. Okay. So number two, the second thing is that I'm very appreciative that I just surround myself. I hire people and I surround myself that one, push back on me, hold me accountable. And I had someone on my team last year say, well, at the beginning of this year when we were, you know, launching Just Work, they were like, look, Chair, last year we got burnt out. You got burnt out and you could not show up and really do the work in the best way. So how do we prevent that from happening? And so what we have done at Just Work is we have recharge days and recharge weeks. So every other Friday is a recharge day and the Just Work office is closed. We don't work. We don't do social media. We don't take any meetings. I do not respond to emails, and we all have the same out of office up. And we also manage that with our clients. So every other Friday is a recharge Friday. And then 1 week every quarter is a recharge week. So actually next week is our recharge week. And so 1 week a quarter and every other Friday is a recharge week and day. And it has been phenomenal. It has genuinely like recharged. And then the third thing is just really understanding what you need that fills yourself back up. And I am very much an introvert, but I love my close, close family and friends. And so sometimes it's, hey, I just need a weekend by myself. And then sometimes it's, I need to get on a plane and go have a tea party with my niece. You know, it just depends, but I give myself the space to, one, ask myself, what do I need? And then to go and do that.
I love that. And it's really just honoring that that is so important, just as important as the work that you're doing in companies. What word would you say chose you over this pandemic time?
What word?
Yeah.
what I used to describe the pandemic, or
just a word that came up for you in terms of any emotions that it brought up, any, I guess, obviously it's really created this drive in you to make sure that organizations are staying diverse and inclusive. But what word would you say really epitomized how you felt during this pandemic time?
Exhausted, Samantha. I mean, we are all exhausted. This is not, I think, you know, it's not like bad things have not happened. Okay, so first, there is a genocide going on in Ethiopia and Tigray. The Ethiopian government is creating a man-made famine and starving a whole group of people. And this has been going on for over a year. It's not the first, and just to add context to that, the Rwandan genocide was 100 days. Okay, so just to put that in context of just how awful and terrible that is. It's not that bad things haven't happened in our world. It's that technology, social media, the immediate consumption that we constantly do of everything that's going on in the world. Like, I just don't feel like as humans, like, that's how we were meant, that we're not built for that. Mm-hmm. So we are all exhausted. But as a Black woman in the United States doing this work in white spaces, I don't know. I am just depleted at times. Mm-hmm. And I have to remind people, I don't do this work. And I do this work because I'm a practitioner. This is my job. Mm-hmm. I do not do this work because I'm a Black woman. And I have to tell people that because sometimes it'll get people in trouble. When we create these brave spaces and we create these spaces for clumsy curiosity, Samantha, I get the most ridiculous questions, right? But that's how we position it, right? And so I have to have the patience to answer it. Mm. But I also have to tell them, don't get your feelings hurt and go talk to like one of your Black friends and then be like, oh my gosh, like these are all my questions. Da, 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 da. I'm like, what? Like, you need to do that work on your own. So don't see me as like, oh, I'm a Black woman and Tria is going to educate me. I'm a practitioner. You are paying me to do this. That is my job. But when I go out for dinner or brunch and, you know, and it'll be mixed crowds, whatever, people who sit at my intersections or don't, they'll be like, Tria, what do you think? Or educate us. I go, no, you have Google.
Yeah.
Go read a book. That's not my job. But if you're going to pay, right? But if you pay me, that's my job. Like, yeah. It's a different framing, but I would say that it's exhausting because it has a different impact to do this work when you do sit at so many different intersections, right? Mm-hmm. I am a woman. I am Black. I am a Black woman. I am a veteran. I am a disabled veteran. You know, so I have both visible and non-visible disabilities. Like, I sit at so many different intersections where it's just like this, and you hear people talk about like, oh, well, we don't need to do that, or that's not important, or not considering that, right? It can be hard at times, but it's important work and it's needed work, and somebody has to do it.
Totally. Oh my gosh, I could talk to you all day, but I am conscious that I don't have all day with you. But what would you say are like maybe three things that someone who is listening to this today thinking, you know, I want to make change where I am at, and I'm maybe just an employee, but I believe I can do this work and I want to do this work. What were three things that you think they could action today?
One, sometimes in order to understand inclusion, we have to start with exclusion. Mm-hmm. And so an exercise that I encourage folks to do, and you can get other folks to do, is that close your eyes and think about the last time you felt excluded. And this is really powerful, especially for the majority, because I work with a lot of like white men that are like, oh, I've never been excluded. But I had this CEO once say, hey, I had a group of friends and we all went to college together, and one of them got married, and I was the only one that wasn't invited to the wedding. And mm-hmm. I said, well, how did that make you feel? And he went on this very, very long long rant about how he felt, how he didn't feel, it didn't feel good. And he felt excluded and he was sad and his feelings were hurt and he was embarrassed and all these different things. And he talked about it with his wife and how consuming it was. And he tried to find out everyone else who was at the wedding. Right. And then I said, yeah. And I was like, and that sounds really terrible. And I said, so now let me tell you, you have people in your organization that feel that way every day, every meeting, every hour, and sometimes every minute. And that's why you need to care about inclusion. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't get it until that. And so he hangs on to that because he's like, I never want anyone in my company to feel the way that I felt when I didn't get invited to that wedding. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we have to start from a place of exclusion to really understand inclusion.
Okay.
Number two, if you're in an organization and you all are not working with professionals in this space, practitioners of DE&I, you are doing yourself a disservice. And if you are only doing the work based off of your diversity working groups or some group that's coming together, you sometimes are actually causing more harm than good. And when you finally do bring in a professional, they have to unwind all of that. So just go out and find the professional, like just start with a consulting and be like, should we hire someone, like do an audit, like just figure out a strategy, right? Mm-hmm. Because when people don't go out and work with professionals, I tell them it's as silly as saying, I have teeth. I don't need a dentist. Okay. You have teeth. And maybe you think that the way to take care of your teeth is that you brush your teeth once a week. Then you meet a dentist and the dentist is like, yeah, you really had good intentions. I see what you were trying to do here, but you actually need to brush your teeth twice a day and you need to floss and do all these other things. And you're like, okay, great. Cause I want healthy teeth and you're going to do it, but you just didn't know what to do. So go work with a professional, right? And then the third thing is that, I tell people it's complex, but it's not complicated. It's complex, but it's not complicated. And we say this thing where we don't hold people accountable to get it done. We hold you capable to get it done, which means you can do it and you are capable of doing it. And so don't over-engineer it. Just understand the work that needs to be done, have a strategy, and then go execute.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. Where can we find out a bit more about your work and you yourself?
Yeah. Well, our website is justworktogether.com. Mm-hmm. And there's also a section where you can reach out and, you know, ask questions. You can share your own stories, your own bias, prejudice, bullying, you know, discrimination, harassment stories, if you'd like. Kim and I love going through that and just understanding, you know, how people are experiencing this in their own workplace. And, you know, if you'd like to work with us, there's information there. And then you can also find me on Twitter, although I don't tweet a lot, but my DMs are open. I'm just at Trier on all socials. So.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Samantha. This was great. Thank you for having me.
Hello, hello. Well, what another fantastic episode. Thank you so much for carving out the time to hang out with us and hear everything that was shared today on our podcast. If you are interested in becoming a change maker and something has piqued your interest and you want to either revamp your own ways of looking at your well-being as you lead a team through change, or maybe you want to create deeper interventions in your company that are going to stick and that people care about actually using, why not join our change maker certification? This is our roadmap to helping you go through our three areas of change: becoming a better change maker, empowering and inspiring others to do the same, and amplifying the message that you have created. Check out all the details of our change maker certification on loveitleaveit.co, and I cannot wait to get started with you. See you soon for another amazing episode. Bye for now.